Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Is gone. I found myself, and no one's left to tell my tale.
Welcome to the Deconstructionist Podcast. I'm your host, John Williamson, and life has been pretty crazy. If you heard the prior message, just want to give everybody an update. I thought that was only fair. Lots going on. And I'm sure I'm not the only one out there who has had similar life. Tragedies, I guess, is the only way to put it. And so I appreciate everyone's patience, and I appreciate the kind words and everything and the outreach. So, but I didn't want to leave you guys hanging. And this is something that I intended to do anyway. This is something that when Adam was still part of the podcast, he and I had talked about way back when. In fact, you'll hear his voice, his beautiful voice again. But we had talked about doing some re-releases. Other podcasts out there who have been around for a long time, you know, occasionally do re-releases. And really, it's just so we can pull some gems out of the archives for folks who are newer listeners and maybe haven't heard some of these episodes before with some of these great guests that we had, you know, almost like 6 years ago now. We've been doing this for almost 7 years, believe it or not. So I'm going to pull some out, and we're going to do a little series on re-releases. So if you've heard these before, but it's been a minute, enjoy. If you've never heard these before, I'm excited for you. The first one, this is a guy that I'm trying to remember back how I found this guy. I feel like he was on a list of like Jewish rabbis to watch for, something like that. He's been around. He's been on the scene for a while. He is an American scholar of Jewish mysticism and neo-Hasidic theologian. He was a founding dean of the non-denominational rabbinical program at Hebrew College in Boston, where he still teaches. He's just incredible. And, you know, when we talk about mysticism, you know, I think I even mentioned this to Richard Rohr, who considers himself a Christian mystic. It seems as if the mystics within each of the major religions are really kind of using the same language and kind of speaking the same language. And it really feels that way. Like they don't get bogged down in the minutiae and the petty arguments that we tend to devolve into. And they really kind of feel like they're using kind of the same, you know, like I said, same language. So I think you'll find some commonalities. I kind of refer to Rabbi Green as kind of the Jewish Richard Rohr. So I think you'll find some commonalities there, and hopefully you enjoy it. But really enjoyed him. He kind of popped some surprises on us when we interviewed him. Turns out he was an understudy of Heschel, which is insane. So Adam and I were quite surprised by that, pleasantly, because that's one of our heroes. So check it out. He's got some, he's a little harder to find in terms of content, but there's some stuff out there. There's a really cool, I think one of the ways I found him too was there was a speaking engagement that he did some years ago that was recorded. It's available by podcast, but he talks about the breath of God, and he uses kind of plays with the Hebrew language a little. And it's just this absolutely beautiful talk that he gives. And so that really kind of hooked me on him. And then I found his book, Radical Judaism. And it's a little trickier to find. Sometimes it's out of print, and so it can be quite expensive. I think it's back in print again, but I know you can still get an e-copy fairly cheap. But highly recommend it. I think I even told him in the interview that it almost, from a marketing perspective, should have just been called Radical Spirituality, because I think it's so much bigger than just Judaism. And it's just a beautiful book. And if you can get a copy of it, highly recommend. So check it out. What else? Still working on new episodes, obviously, you know, with the things going on, you know, with the passing of my mom and my dad's major surgery coming up. or actually by the time this releases, it'll probably have happened. So hopefully it has gone smoothly. But with all that stuff going on, you know, obviously, you know, everything else kind of gets pushed to the wayside. And so I think hopefully you'll understand if it's been a minute since there's been new content, had to take a month off to kind of, you know, get things together. And, you know, again, you guys know I'm a huge proponent of mental health. And so, you know, as soon as that started happening, you know, the things, started going south with mom, you know, I started getting back into therapy on a weekly basis and trying to make sure I'm grieving properly and that I'm there for my daughter in the best way possible. So hopefully you guys understand that. And, working on recording new episodes. So I will have new content out, before the end of the year. My hope is by some point in, October, November, start to release some new content there. But in the meanwhile, wanted to get some of these re-releases out to you guys. I think this will be really fun. So, I'll have some topics that we found that were really fun. And once we get a little closer to October, plan on re-releasing some of the kind of Halloween themed sort of episodes that we've done over the years, because I just think that's kind of fun. So hope you guys enjoy this. If you like the podcast, please subscribe, rate, and review. Tell a friend. Word of mouth is the biggest way that we've been able to get our podcast out there to the masses. So appreciate all the support. Again, new content coming, and we'll finish up the year, and then, you know, I'll take my usual month off in January, possibly February, just to get interviews booked and recorded, and then we'll hit the ground running in 2023, believe it or not. So thank you guys so much for your support, and enjoy these episodes. But without further ado, I give you Rabbi Arthur Green. Do you water I am treading is now my own. Well, Rabbi Green, we are delighted, we are ready, and we are just so happy to have you with us here today on the Deconstructionist Podcast. Thank you so much for giving us some of your time.
Thank you, my pleasure.
You've got a really interesting story, and for those of our listeners that get a copy of your book that John and I are just devouring right now, it's called Radical Judaism. You give little snippets of your story, and a lot of us that are listening to this podcast, I know John and I both have stories of how, you know, we were raised this way, and we, you know, we felt these kinds of things and these kinds of desires and found ourselves, you know, then maybe in this place. And we kind of call that, you know, a deconstruction. And a lot of us came from like hyper-religious backgrounds, and we're kind of wrestling with pulling some of that off and, you know, looking at things a different way. And I know you have a really good story. If you could just kind of take us back through your story and how you kind of ended up with the style of teaching and the perspective that you currently have, which is just so wonderful. If you could just kind of give us some insight into that.
Well, my goodness, we could spend all our time on that, but I'll try to do it with some brevity. I'm an American Jew, third generation in America. That means my grandparents were all immigrants from Eastern Europe. My parents were born here shortly after their parents immigrated at the turn of the 20th century. I was raised in a good Jewish atheist home. Dad was a militant atheist. His parents were already militant atheists from the old country. They had left behind their parents' Hasidic piety when they moved from small town to a big city in Poland. And most of my father's aunts and uncles actually were Communist Party members, which was not unusual for Jews in the Bronx at that time of history. My grandparents were not communists, but they shared that absolutely negative view of religion. Religion was the opiate of the masses. It was old-fashioned. It was reactionary. And we were liberated, intelligent people who had gotten away from that nonsense. My dad married a woman, my mother, from a fairly traditional Jewish family, not Orthodox. My grandfather's tailor shop was open on Saturdays, so he didn't observe the Sabbath strictly. But upstairs from the tailor shop in my grandmother's apartment, everything was strictly kosher. There were certain things you didn't do on the Sabbath, and candles were lit and so on, and lots of personal piety was observed. I became very close to my mother's parents. The story is that my mother died of cancer when I was 11 years old. My mother's only brother died 2 years later. My grandparents were absolutely devastated. And I was the grandchild from among seven or eight who was really attracted to old people, who loved stories about the old country, who was interested in religion. When I was 7 or 8 years old, I was taking my mother to a temple on Friday nights. I don't quite understand why. She was willing to go along with me. Maybe she was not quite as atheist as her husband was. And maybe already being ill, she needed the consolations of religion. So my mother began it, but my grandparents, I started going to my grandparents every weekend for every Jewish holiday. And I entered into the world of my grandparents' East European piety. The synagogue they went to was unaffiliated, old-fashioned, the corner of Eastern Europe in northern New Jersey, transplanted into northern New Jersey. And I took to it like a duck to water. Mm-hmm. I was a child among older people. And the truth is, as a kid, I was terrified of kids my age, but I got along very well with old people who fed you lots of chicken soup and Yiddish conversation and what have you. So I became quite observant, quite traditionally observant as an adolescent. That became the subject of terrible battles with my father, who thought it was all ridiculous nonsense. And I fought for it. By the time I started college, I was 16 years old when I went over to college, and I left home having become an Orthodox Jew. But that only lasted about a year and a half into college.
Wow.
As I turned 18, I realized that I didn't really believe in it. I was using God as a way to seek consolation from the unresolved trauma of my mother's death.
Wow.
I was pretending that I believe. I was deeply attached to a kind of compulsive need to do everything right and please God and please my grandmother and make sure I was a good boy. And on the eve of my 18th birthday, I went out of the dormitory to town, to a nearby town. I walked into a restaurant and ate two non-kosher hamburgers, and that was the end of my period of adolescent piety.
Man.
I think after one hamburger, I might have repented. it was just too good out there. So I gave it all up. I was secular. I no longer believed. And I tried for a year or so to say, I am a secular person. I'm a secular Jew. I tried on intensive Zionism for a while as an alternative to religion. I tried on what was called Yiddish cultural Judaism, which was a sort of, we are members of a people and we have an ancient literature and a beautiful language, but we don't believe in religion anymore. That lasted for about a year. And then I discovered, that was the year when I went through, I would say, secular existentialism. I went from Sartre to Camus, and from Camus I wound up with Kafka. And I was reading Nietzsche in three or four different courses in college that year. God is dead, the joy. I went from the joy of God is dead, which means the old authority system is broken, to the loneliness of Kafka. My God, there's no God out there. There's also no meaning and no reason to live and no air to breathe and nothing to love. And then I went to Camus, who said, if there's no meaning, you have to make meaning for yourself. I remember I read when I was 18 or 19 a book that influenced me greatly. I reread it a couple of years ago, and it's still a nice book. And that is a spiritual autobiography of a man called Nikos Kazantzakis, great Greek writer. He wrote an autobiography called Report to Greco, where he talks about how mankind has been struggling to reach the top of the mountaintop, because we've been told at the top of the mountain, if you reach around the top of the mountain, you will find the face of God. And the human being with the last ounce of his strength finally pulls and pulls and pulls himself up the mountain. And at the top of the mountain, he reaches around and he feels nothing but sheer cliff.
Wow.
He says, what do you do at that moment? You take a chisel out of your pocket and begin carving the face of God for yourself. And that felt like what I was doing. I had no longer had faith, but I had to recreate meaning. But then when I was 20, people began introducing me to the Jewish mystical tradition, the mystical tradition which had mostly been rejected by modern Jews, but still existed in some corners of the Hasidic world and the world of ultra-piety. And in the mystical tradition, I found a new understanding of God and a new understanding of what it meant to be a religious human being that spoke to my heart and brought me back to a very different kind of religion. It wasn't about compulsive observance. It wasn't about guilt. It wasn't about the old man in the sky who was watching and counting your good deeds and your bad deeds. All that was gone. But there was a deep resonance of a oneness of the universe, of a oneness of being, of a deep mystery that brought us all together and unified us with life. And I felt that was the kind of religious language my heart had been looking for all along. And so I came back to Judaism, but on a much more profound level and in a much more liberated way, and began recreating a Judaism for myself that I now have been fashioning since I was 20, and I'm now 76. So for the past 56 years, I've been involved in this ongoing quest to try to find a spiritually rich and at the same time intellectually honest and open-hearted and loving and non-guilt-producing form of Judaism for myself and other Jews like me.
Oh, that's amazing. I love what you say at the very, very beginning of your book to kind of follow this train of thought here. You say, for me, God is not an intellectual proposition, but rather the ground of life itself. And this sounds a lot like within the Christian tradition, the way Paul Tillich describes the divine, or even in the Hindu tradition, what they describe as the ground of being. What do you mean when you say the ground of life itself?
It's the oneness out of which all multiplicity springs. It's the silence out of which all sound grows and against the background of which all sound has to be heard. It's the primal darkness that is the source for that which says, let there be light. It exists prior to everything else, but that priority is not really one of time, it's one of structure or logic. It's the undefined one out of which all forms emerge. All of them are part of the one, all of them go back to the one, but the one is infinitely more than the sum of its parts. It's the one that embraces all beings. And you know the Hebrew word for God is Yud-Heh-Vav-Heh. I don't know if it's in my book, I transliterate it. I write it Y-H-W-H. We're not allowed to pronounce that word in Hebrew. It's too mysterious. But it really is an impossible conjugation of the verb to be. The original Hebrew name of God really should be translated is, was, will be. Because it's past, present, and future all sort of smushed together in a form that doesn't exist in the language. So that's kind of what I mean by it.
Oh, that's great. Also in your book, and I found this to be this to hit close to home for us, one of the things that I think even within the Christian tradition that we seem to be fighting against is this postmodern idea of religion being this list of things that you check off in terms of, I have great attendance, I behave myself, and therefore, we call it escape plan theology. And it's turned into this very, this morality play, essentially. And you talk about this even within Judaism, this modern concept of God that's focused on morality and human behavior and things along those lines. But you say that is not God, and you focus instead on origins, which I thought was really fascinating. Why is this an important distinction?
Well, let me just quickly say that morality is good. I believe in morality. I'm not disparaging it. But it seems to me that the one is bigger than that, because the one is the one that exists behind and before any distinctions. Just like that includes the distinction between light and darkness, it also includes the distinction between good and evil. So that the one has to embrace all that is. But I think there is a morality that proceeds from our faith in oneness. I want to say that very clearly. I think religion is a moral system. But my morality comes out of a sense of I am one with all others. I'm one with all other human beings. I'm one with all creatures. why would I want to do violence to myself? Why would I want to harm another part of myself? In Christian language, you probably call it Corpus Christi, the single body of Christ in which all beings are a part. And not just all Christians, of course, but all beings.
Yeah, right.
In Judaism, we would call it the form of primordial man, Adam Kadmon, in Kabbalistic language. And that's the same thing, the primordial Adam that contains all souls within it. So we are. So I believe in the oneness of humanity and the oneness of being, and that calls forth, that makes moral demand on me, of course. You know, it's not religion. We Jews believe it's not religion until it makes demands on you. That's very serious for us. It has to ask the question, how am I going to live in the face of this truth? And only then does it become serious. That call of Sinai, however we reinterpret Sinai, that call of Sinai is still very much there for us. The sort of how are you going to respond to my call?
So good. Man, I love that. One of the first things that struck me in your introduction, it's just a phrase that you use, but I can tell it's a very important phrase to you. Radical amazement being the starting point of your life. Will you just talk about that? What do you mean by that? Why is it so important?
Well, that's not my phrase. That's my teacher's phrase.
Yeah.
I had the great privilege of being a close student and disciple of Abraham Joshua Heschel.
Oh, wow. Heschel. Wow.
And Heschel writes about radical amazement. I was in rabbinical school for a year, and I was about to quit because it was an awfully confining place that was giving out an awful lot of, I thought, primitive theology. And one of my teachers saw I was about to leave, and he said, if you had a program of private study with Professor Heschel, would you stay in rabbinical school? And I said, yes. And I became Heschel's private student for 4 years. And that was one of the very great privileges of my life.
Oh, my God.
Heschel used the phrase radical amazement. If you go to his great, great book, God in Search of Man, the first 100 pages are all about radical amazement as the very basis of religion. Heschel talked about how Heschel had a phrase, I asked for wonder. God asked me what gift I would like to have more than anything else in the world. Would it be wisdom? Would it be wealth? And he said, I asked for wonder. I asked to maintain my child's sense of wonder throughout my life. And religion begins with a sense of wonder. And preserving it and evoking it in people who are jaded and conventional is one of the things a real religious teacher is all about, reawakening the sense of wonder.
Yeah, wonder. Man, I think a lot of people in our generation, you know, this podcast is called the Deconstructionist Podcast, and it's a lot of people wrestling with the tradition they've been given, and like you, seeking to find a home somewhere in it where, you know, there's a new balance or some new meaning being found. And a lot of us are getting in touch with something that you got in touch with right on the heels of this, you know, kind of thing, this encounter with the mystical tradition. A lot of us are realizing that mysticism is a component that our post-Enlightenment, cerebral, rational, Kantian culture has just really lost sight of. And there's a lot of power and depth and radical amazement in mysticism. You said that in mystical tradition saved Judaism for you. Could you tell us a little bit about what you mean by mysticism and how mysticism saved Judaism for you?
Scholars devote whole courses and whole semesters and whole books to to definitions of mysticism. So I can't say anything too definitive.
That's all right.
But let me throw out a few things. A mystic is a person who believes that that the core of religion is the possibility of a direct encounter with God or with the One or with the ultimate truth. That there is such a thing as an experience standing directly in the presence of God. And that experience is transformative. It is an experience that is somehow always about lifting a veil or revealing a secret or penetrating more deeply into the nature of the soul, into the nature of the world, into the nature of the text. You have to lift the veil in order to see a deeper truth than that which is immediately apparent. I mean, everything in religion, everything else in religion, the stories, the music, the hymns, the dogmas, the history, everything else is there to take you to that experience, to lead you to that experience, and then to bring you back from that experience and help you plant it in your daily life and help you uplift your daily life in the face of that experience. That's what it's all about. The whole of religion is about that core, which is leading you to that experience and bringing you back from it. And that experience, coming in many different forms, is always about oneness. Where I thought there were many, there turns out to be only one. You see the ultimate oneness of being, the core that unites all things. Christians may see it as you know, the three parts of the Trinity are one. In Judaism, it revolves around the phrase, "Hear, O Israel, our God is one." The Hindu will talk about Atman and Brahman and overcoming the 10,000 forms of Maya. Buddhism will have its own way of talking about it, though it won't use the word God. It will hear that sort of in the breath of life, responding to the breath of life and awareness. There are many different forms of it, but it has the ultimate simplicity of oneness about its truth. And the simplicity of oneness is a beautiful truth. And that's where all the paths lead, I believe. I'm sympathetic. I'm not completely identified with it, but I'm sympathetic to the perennialists among scholars of religion who believe that all the paths lead to the same truth, and that there is a core of religious experience that unifies spiritual seekers across the world, even though we speak very different languages, have different symbols and different sounding theologies. There is a mystical core of that longing for the one and ability to discover the one, to have glimpses of the one that transform one's life. I saw that in the Hasidic masters, and Hasidism is a form of popular mysticism in Judaism. I saw that in the teachings of the Hasidic masters, and I fell in love with it. And when I was 20 years old, somebody gave me a particular essay in Hebrew about some of the early Hasidic teachings. And I said, yes, this is my religious language. I will speak this language the rest of my life. And I will spend my life trying to translate and make this language available to people. And that's what I've done. I have led a very mission-driven life for the last 56 years. My life is about something. It's about the discovery of that inner oneness and the Jewish pathways to it, and translating and making accessible the documents and the teachings that lead there. That's what I do.
Wow, and we're so glad you did.
We're so glad.
We're all benefiting from it, for sure. But one thing I know that you mentioned in the book that I would love you to expand upon a little bit is you also refer to yourself as a religious humanist. What exactly does that mean?
I love that phrase so much.
I'm glad. Read Martin Buber, read Heschel. They are religious humanists. They are Jewish religious humanists. But I think that Tillich would also be one too. By humanism, I mean that there is no God who is going to come and set the world right when we destroy it. The history of civilization and the fate of this planet are in our hands, God save us. But God won't save us. The God who will save us is the God within us, the God who will motivate us to wake up and to do something transformative before it's too late. I'm very involved in environmental concern and desperately worried, of course, about what's going on in our nation right now. It's all up to us. We have ultimate responsibility for our lives and for the civilization we have created. That's what I mean by humanism. Humanity is important. Humanity has ultimate concern and ultimate responsibility. But religious humanism means that we won't act on that responsibility until we discover that we live for a deeper purpose, that we reflect something of what our tradition calls the image of God, which is to say there's a depth and an infinity that lies behind our consciousness, which is the consciousness of the one of which we are all part. And until we recognize that, we will not be able to act in a way that will bring about the salvation of our world.
Mm.
So salvation depends on us, but it will only come in recognizing this deeper holistic truth.
Our bodies come in different shapes and sizes, so doesn't it make sense that our weight loss plans should too? That's the beauty of Noom. They build a personal plan that factors in dietary restrictions, medical issues, and other personal needs so your plan works for you. Noom doesn't restrict or shame when you want to treat yourself. Their flexible program focuses on progress instead of perfection. You don't have to give up carbs or anything. And with their daily lessons, you can learn something new about your food choices every day. After just a few days of using the app, I learned how to recognize cues for overeating and how to choose the right foods to feel full. Stay focused on what's important to you with Noom's psychology and biology-based approach. Sign up for your trial today at Noom.com. That's Noom.com. And check out Noom's first ever cookbook, The Noom Kitchen, for 100 healthy and delicious recipes to promote better living. Available to buy now wherever books are sold.
I think this would be the perfect time. One of the sections of your book that I really, really enjoyed, enjoyed all of it, but this part in particular, where you talk about God's call to mankind and the question, where are you? And you look at three specific things, or three specific sections, mind, heart, and deed, in terms of being ways that we have to answer that question or respond. I wondered if you could go into that a little bit.
So that's the first word God speaks to a human being in the Bible. Yes. God says to Adam, where are you? That to me is revelation. That's the beginning of revelation. You know, Judaism is a religion of revelation. In Judaism, the question is not, as it is in Christianity, are you saved? In Judaism, the question is, do you hear God's word? Do you hear God speaking? We are the way Christ is the center of a central symbol of religion for Christians. Sinai is the central symbol for Judaism. Do you stand at the mountain and hear God's word? The orthodoxy to which I was attracted as a teenager said that you have to believe that every single word of the Torah, of the five books of Moses, was spoken by God on Mount Sinai. And I stopped believing that for a whole series of reasons, including biblical criticism. But I still believe there is such a thing as a divine word. That word is the word spoken to Adam, where are you? Now, it's not that God says it in English or in Hebrew or in any other language. That word is addressed to us in the same way it's addressed to us by instinct. The same way every animal hears a voice within it that says, eat, thrive, reproduce, eat, reproduce, thrive, eat, drink. It knows what it needs to eat in order to survive. Birds know they have to feed those babies in order for the thing to work. And they bring those worms to the nest. That's because a voice within them says, feed those baby birds. Because of the advances of the growth of mind in human beings, we have a voice in us that says, eat, thrive, survive, reproduce, make meaning. Figure out what you're doing here. Where are you? Where are you means what are you doing with your life? Why have you come to exist on this planet? What's your life all about? You are challenged. That's the voice of God. The voice within us, speaking instinctively within us, that says, figure it out. Figure out what you're doing here and do something worthwhile. Now that where are you for us is spoken again at Sinai when God says, I am. I am the Lord your God who brought you forth from Egypt. I am that liberating power that that rises within you. Worship nothing else as a god. Those first two commandments of Sinai, I am the Lord your God and worship nothing else, are really just a repetition of that divine where are you that calls out to Adam and hence to every human being. And the rest is commentary. The rest is all a way to figure out how to respond to the divine I am and worship nothing else. Those are the essential commandments of our Torah for me. And they all exist in that first challenge where God says, where are you? And I hear that where are you constantly in my life. Now, when I turned 70 years old, I heard it in a whole different way. Because at 70, you'll discover that someday long from now, I guess. At 70, you suddenly hear the psalmist's voice in your ear who says the days of our lives are 70 years, and if by strength, 80 years. And you know that it's time to start reaping the harvest and to say, what do I still want to do in my life? And that voice, where are you, comes back again in a new way. And it's been speaking to me very loudly for these last 6 years and has made me a very creative and giving and loving person.
Oh, that's beautiful. One of our favorite authors that we refer to a lot on our show is the Franciscan Father Richard Rohr, who talks a lot about the limitations with dualism and dualistic thinking and when speaking about the transcendent specifically. And you also mentioned issues with dualism within your book, and I would just love to hear your thoughts on that.
So let's go back to the first chapter of Genesis. Everything that's created is created in pairs. Heaven and earth, light and darkness, day and night, dry land and sea, sun and moon, male and female, everything is pairs. It's the beginning of duality. Only God is one. In Hebrew, the book of Genesis begins with the letter bet. Bereshit is in the beginning. And that letter b in Hebrew also serves as the number two. So creation is the beginning of duality, the beginning of multiplicity. Sometimes I like to say, the one decides to put on the coat of many colors and become the many. Multiplicity flows forth from the oneness of being. That's a different way of understanding creation. Of course, I'm not a biblical literalist. I'm not a creationist. You know that. I'm a believer in evolution. But evolution is also a way of saying, in the beginning, God created. It's our new creation story. And it, too, is a sacred story. That's very important to me. And I say that in the first chapter of the book. Evolution, we have to make evolution into a new sacred story. We have to discover the divine element, the divine mystery in every stage of the evolutionary process. This great wonder called the evolution of life on our planet. How did it happen? How did it happen that descendants of one-celled creatures beneath the sea grew complex enough to be able to step onto dry land? And how did it happen that that ecology is so developed that flowers and bees would be in the same area so they could fructify one another? How did it happen that et cetera, et cetera, et cetera? All that is the great divine mystery of evolution, and that is the one entering into the dance of multiplicity, the one putting on the coat of many colors, the one that begins toing, the one that begins multiplying and begins saying, I will enter into the realm of the two so that there be reproduction, so that there be generation. And therefore, the Kabbalistic language, you know, is very much a sexual language. The language of pairing of male and female is very much part of the Kabbalistic secret of being, of how being came to exist. But it all goes back to that ultimate one that underlies all the twos. So to play the game in Hebrew, as I say, creation begins with bet, and bet means two. It's the language of, it's the origin of duality. But at Sinai, when God speaks and says, I am, Anochi, I am, begins with Aleph, because that's when the one reveals itself as standing behind the multiple universe.
Oh, man. So we want to be sensitive to your time. So I think the right question to end on, I think, is something that we're fascinated with and that we've talked a lot about on the podcast, which is the role of myth when it comes to sacred texts, and specifically, and how we see myth as being different than the connotation that the word has taken on in modern times, and specifically that within Scripture, something can be truer than true without being historically necessarily true. And I know you talk about this a lot with the Eden story and Cain and Abel. I just wondered if you could go into that a little bit.
Yes, I'm all for what I call the remythologization of religion. We went through a period of demythologization from Kant on, from 19th century on, and now we have to recover the myths that we once laid aside. In the third chapter of the book, I have a section about myth, because myth to me means a story that reveals a truth that is so profound and mysterious you couldn't know it except by knowing that story. And so the story hides that truth within it, but it also reveals it. If I just told you that truth, it would become flat and dogmatic. But if I ensconce it in the living reality of myth, then it becomes living and vibrant and dynamic. However, myth is very dangerous stuff. Remember, some very bad people have used myth in the course of the 20th century. Remember the Aryan myths of the Nazis and the nationalist myths that arose in various parts of Europe in the early 20th century. The essentialism of the true Romanian or Hungarian or Italian spirit, which was going to reassert itself and purify itself of all these dirty foreigners. I'm one of those dirty foreigners, as you know, and so I am very sensitive to the dangers of myth. It can't just be my myth against your myth, because then we have World War III.
Exactly.
So I want to say myths that are about the universal human situation, what it means to be a human being, what it means to live in the world, how we seek for truth, how we nurture our lives, how we raise children. Those myths are very profound and valuable. But myths that are about one group of people against another group of people, we have to be wary of and protect ourselves against, whether they're the myths of white people against black people or mud people against this kind of people. It's not simply that all myth is good. Myth is a very valuable tool, but I think the vehicle is the universalism, the universality of the myth. And the universal myths will save us from the racist and nationalist and misogynist myths that also exist out there. So myth is a tool to be used with a lot of discernment. But we can't have a spiritual life without it.
Oh, that's perfect. I can't think of a better way to end our conversation today.
We constructed these walls and I found a business where the company line was the only way to get paid.
Deconstructionist listeners, Can you get with me, John? Could we please, deconstructionist listeners, please, let's blow Art Green up.
Yes,
everybody needs to know about this guy.
Yes, I remember, I remember the first time that you and I, because Adam and I, like, when we'll like order a ton of books when we're like thinking of like guests we're gonna have on or like themes that we want to explore, and we'll get these books, we'll start to read them, and then we just kind of, have a sit down and we talk about it. Mm-hmm. We're like, hey, man, you know, what did you think about this? Like, these are the points that stuck out to me in this book. And I remember it was funny, like when you and I first talked about this book and this guy, it was kind of like the first time that we ever talked about, like when we had read Falling Up, or like the first time we read Pete Rollins, or like Tillich, or you name it, you know, where we were just like, whoa.
So good.
What this guy is doing is just like, I mean, we were just talking about this before we started to record. Like, it makes me see this very, very obvious connection in between those practicing kind of like mysticism amongst different religions and how they're speaking a lot of the same language. I'm not saying that they're all the same.
No, I know exactly what you mean. I mean, I think I can't remember who there's a quote that I just recently read where it was like, you know, where all the theologians of the world have all like, you know, been busy arguing over the centuries, the mystics were all like, whatever. Like they were all just like speaking the same language, hanging out, like keeping it together, like holding it at the center.
Yeah.
You know, the mystics of all the religions that are aware, that great Meister Eckhart quote, like anytime you say God, you say less than God.
Right.
You know, you can't nominate God. Like, I pray God rid me of God, you know, like that kind of stuff. And like when he talks about, like, we're going to put in the show notes that sermon that he gave at that synagogue.
There's a podcast. So if you go on iTunes or whatever podcast device or app that you happen to use, if you search Congregation Emmanuel, EMANU-EL, or just search Arthur Green in there, it's under that church's or that temple's podcast, and it's a talk that he gave on November 21st, 2014. Just on the breath of God.
The name of God being the breath of God, being, you know, mystery, being, oh.
Yes.
So good. Like, amazing, wonderful stuff.
Yeah.
Oh, there are so many things I love about this. I think, you know, if you get the book Radical Judaism, first thing you're going to look at the cover and you're going to go, oh.
Judaism.
And then you're going to open this thing up and hear him say things like this: the spiritual work that each of us has to do consists primarily of letting go, allowing that presence to enter our consciousness and transform us. He says, if you believe as I do that the presence of God is everywhere, our chief task is that of becoming aware. That kind of stuff.
Yes.
That kind of stuff.
We started talking about this in the intro. I don't think we finished the thought, but like Adam and I were just talking about how this is like the worst title of a book ever, because it doesn't
it really is.
It doesn't do the book justice. And it says Radical Judaism,
right?
But it's so much bigger than
It's so much bigger than that. I looked at that book and the title kind of said to me, like, okay, so you've been kind of Jewish. Now it's time to like go radical with your Judaism. And really, it's more like what Rob Bell would say, or, you know, I can't even remember if he got it from somewhere else, where he talks about the word rad, you know, radish. Radical comes from the Latin radix, which means like root. And it's like going back to and that is exactly what he's doing. He's taking us back to the roots of these basic words, like Torah, Yahweh, the concept of the image of God, the people of God, these basic concepts. And he's showing, kind of like Tillich would or Heschel would, the vast, both mystical and very concrete, practical, just transcendence that's in all that stuff that's around us. So I guess, you know, a good question that I want to start incorporating a little bit in these little kind of rehashings that we do at the end of these episodes, because I think this will be helpful for people, is like, in terms of like construction, in terms of like, you know, deconstruction, reconstruction, just the journey of faith, how does this kind of thinking, John, make you think new things? How does it expand your mind? Like, how is this aiding in your journey? Like, when you read things like Art Green, when you hear him say the kinds of things that he just said, like, what does it do to you?
Well, for me, I think the two things primarily that it does is, number one, it gives me hope, because I see and identify with so much of the material that he's talking about, these universal things that he discusses in the book. And I'm like, you know what? We're not really that far away. It's just, we're not seeking to understand.
Mm.
And once we do seek to understand, it feels like a lot of that crap just kind of goes away, you know? And I think that's the biggest thing, like, especially in today's day and age, man, like, it's hard to be on social media some days because you just see so much of the byproduct of all of the disagreements and the areas where we don't get along and we don't seek to understand and we, you know, we just assume things about one another instead of actually getting to know your neighbor.
Yeah, man.
So this gives me a lot of hope, man. It just, it really does. And I think it was, it may have been Rohrer Bell, somebody a long time ago said, you know, a lot of times by reading other religions, you start to appreciate certain things about your own religion that much more.
Absolutely.
Or you understand it a little bit better. And we said this when we had Wolpe on, you know, we're primarily a Jewish people originally.
Yeah.
Know? Jesus was a Jew. No. We forget this.
No.
Yeah.
No. He wore Levi's. He had Converse All-Stars. Or at least Birkenstocks.
5'10s for sure. Maybe 5'11s.
And he was white.
Super skinny. Yeah. But like, you know, it's like we forget, like, we were born out of this great tradition of Judaism. Mm-hmm. And so like, who else, you know, would we want to talk to when we're talking about the Old Testament specifically? You know, if we want to get a different perspective or like a fresh set, you know, fresh perspective on some of the old stories that we've read time and time again.
Yeah, absolutely. I think for me, what this did that's very similar to reading Richard Rohr, Paul Tillich, Pete Rollins, you know, Rob Bell, a lot of the guys that we've had on the show, the thing that gets me excited, like it gets me just, like you used the word hope, being a 7 on the Enneagram, I use words like exciting and optimistic and things like that. Cause I just feel so good about where this whole conversation globally can continue to go. And for me personally, coming back to my tradition, when I hear things like this, I think what started off this whole podcast was we were feeling claustrophobic. The room was too small. The truths were too small. There was too much cockiness and confidence, and there was too many periods and not enough question marks. There were too many periods and not enough ellipses. And what I see in this is it's, oh no, you don't know the bounds of this.
Yeah.
This is pervasive. It's universal. It's huge. It's expansive. It's inviting. It's a journey. Every word in this book, this little book, Radical Judaism, opened up a whole new world to something that I had considered complacent and dry. And it's like, oh, this is so big.
Yeah.
It's amazing. It's kind of like when you're stuck in traffic and you're just kind of like, you've got a low grade, just bitterness kind of going on. And it's just like, you know what I mean? Like just a low grade, just hum of bitterness, just about like your whole situation at that current moment.
Yeah.
Or you're late and you know, and like if for 2 seconds you can just remember that we are on a ball of debris hurtling through an infinite multiverse probably that is so expansive, and with our best technology, we haven't found any spot in this world where life is even possible.
Yeah.
And yet here I am stuck in traffic.
Yeah.
You know, sometimes you need a wide angle to make you appreciate your tiny little space. Yeah. And that's what I feel like a lot of these guys do. And that's why I love this journey that we continue to just invite people into. I love it.
I imagine it's similar to like the first time like a scientist walked up to somebody and was like, and like the prevalent thought at the time was like, yeah, the Earth is the center of the galaxy. And he's like, actually, no, there are like billions of other stars.
Yeah.
Besides yours, and then like blew this guy's mind, and then you know, and then at one point in our lifetime, they thought that the universe was like ceasing to expand or whatever,
mm-hmm.
and that it was like slowing down,
right? Because it theoretically it kind of should have been,
yeah. And then so they find out
dark matter and dark energy come into the equation.
They're like, actually, it's expanding at a rapid pace,
and it's speeding up.
Yeah,
yeah.
They're like, what?
What?
So this thing never ends.
I love it.
It hurts my brain, but at the same time, I'm like, that is the coolest thing. I mean,
because I'll close with this
yeah.
to tie it back to like, you know, at the end of the day, you and I identify as Christian. and we're gonna, I think, gonna continue to do so.
Sure.
I don't want to speak for you.
Why not? Yeah.
I'll still love you, John. But yeah. But to tie this back to our, you know, and then I'll stop rambling because obviously I could just keep doing this. But like to tie it back to like our tradition, I think one of the fundamental things I learned when I was a kid is, you know, we're supposed to worship. And that I remember reading, my dad walked me through Proverbs when I was a kid, and it said, you know, the fear of the Lord, you know, is the beginning of knowledge.
Yeah.
And one of the things that I have realized through this journey that I've gone on with you and through all these people that we've talked to, and it's hopefully never going to stop, is that I think worship starts with feeling small and significant at the same time. It's like this texture, this tension of wonder, where a huge realization comes into a very small space. Do you know what I mean? Like,
yeah,
almost like the Doctor Who, like, yeah, it's this tiny little,
was that,
didn't
was
Pete
that
Rollins just say this or something? Somebody just said this, where it's like this tiny little space. But when you know what's inside that thing, it's bigger than everything.
That was a Sarah Bessie reference, wasn't it? That was just for Sarah Bessie.
That just was now. Just for Sarah Bessie, just there. So this is all about making me a better worshiper.
Yeah.
It's about making me a better Christian, honestly.
Yeah.
That's taking it more seriously and packing more significance into this tiny little package of me and my consciousness. And I just love it, man. It just, the reverence and the humility that comes out of letting it be bigger and bigger and bigger and bigger. I'll never get sick of this.
No. Nope. And we will always be excited, because if we can continue to bring you guests like this, there's no reason not to be. So please go get his book.
Please.
Go tweet about him, Facebook about him, get the word out. This guy's doing a tremendous work, and we can't recommend it high enough. The band this week is actually from some listeners. They're a band called Holy Fools, and they just had an album that came out. I'm sorry, guys. I got your name backwards. The album is called Holy Fools. The band is called Wild Earth.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah.
Let me get that right.
I'm super stoked to have them on. Sense. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Wild Earth. Sorry, guys. Wild Earth. Your album is called Holy Fools, but it came out on August 11th, so it'll be out by the time this podcast airs, which is a day after my birthday. Guys, if you really want to do it up, you should have done it on my birthday.
Come on.
On the 10th. Come on.
Come on.
But
happy birthday, John.
Thank you, man. Happy birthday to you, too. Yeah, both, Adam just had one.
Both August birthdays.
And we're going to go out and celebrate this week.
Yeah, we
so.
Are.
But go check out their music. It's really, really good stuff. We've gotten a chance to preview some of their tracks before the album came out. Can't recommend it enough. Beautiful stuff. And we also have some other big news coming up. Our Patreon campaign will finally be launching. It may even have been launched by the airing of this episode. We'll see.
Mm-hmm.
Depends on how our work dinner goes tonight. So... So thank you guys in advance. Anybody who has emailed us and asked about this, and we're sorry it's taken so long. We're very, very busy. So we worked really hard to get this thing done and out there. And we're really excited about some of the packages and stuff that we put together for
you
guys.
We're just excited to have another way to connect to you guys. Because at the end of the day, we want to just create more and more opportunities for that. That is all we're about. The connection that comes with all this idea sharing and this community and this keeping each other company on the wild, weird journey that we're all on. So thank you for now.
Yeah.
We are your hosts. I'm Adam Narlock.
And I'm John Williamson.
Grace and peace, everybody.
Try to help the world to recover. I sat myself in your pews every single week, and I gave you my money so that you would tell me what to. Out of But I think there's a way for us to love.